Welcome to Community Encode, the podcast about the human beings behind the commits. I'm here today with Tammy Lister, who is the co-founder of Gildenburg, who's a longtime WordPress core contributor, has done other sort of product-y stuff. Welcome to the show, Tammy, and tell us about yourself.
Oh, thank you. So I guess the best role to summarize what I do, or the one that's most fitting, is a product engineer. I like to do most or touch most things with product. And I do lots of different things. So I generally like to work with people with product. So in Gildenburg, what we do is we call it product consultancy, but we do all the way across from, have you got an idea? That's awesome. We can help you, through to, you have an idea. How do you do partnerships? How do you kind of get that idea out? How do you scale it? And how do you, if you are someone who's looking for products as well, so if you're a host or if you are a looking to collaborate. So lots of different work there that I do. And also in my core work, I like to do a range of different things, including operations as well. So as long as it's product, I'm super happy to get involved in it.
Yeah. Talk about Gildenburg a little bit. What's a Gildenburg, and how did that come to be?
So it's not a Pokemon, which is kind of what I feel it should be. So it started out, Jonathan Wold, he started doing it. It's an interesting thing of, it's a project that has had other co-founders and it's kind of evolved. So currently it is Jonathan Wold, Luke Harbus, and myself. And Luke, he works kind of a combination of, he also works doing plugin reviews as well, and I also work on core. So we had that kind of hybrid working with core as well, insights. And what it is that we work with people who are anywhere on their product journey or anywhere who are trying to work with products, and we cooperate with them and either give them advice on that space, or we try and match them with different products as well. So it's a whole different range. There's so many different things that we try and do. It could be, I might be doing a product review, I might be trying to match a product, I might be trying to find out how two products can work together, or product and host can work together. Lots of different things.
Yeah, and so we, I say we meaning Pantheon, mm-hmm. This isn't the Pantheon podcast, but I happen to work at Pantheon. We've been talking to y'all in that context mm-hmm. for a while, mm-hmm. and I personally am well aware that you have a lot of connections with a lot of sort of products in the mm-hmm. WordPress space, and even a little bit abroad from that. But it's the sort of thing that, for me, as, I don't know, maybe a skeptical engineer dev brain, mm-hmm. That it feels like why would I want to talk to people to tell me what would I gain? But obviously you've had that relationship with a lot of different people. So what do companies typically come to Gildenburg looking for?
Yeah, so I think it depends on where you are in your journey. If you are, you generally are at a growth point in your journey when you need someone else to collaborate with. So fair. That can be that you've been on your own rocking it with a plugin, and now you're like, oh, well, what if? What could be my next stage? How do I grow this? And rather than you could suddenly go out and employ lots of people and you could suddenly make that leap, but you probably don't want to do that straight off. You probably want to see whether you could do some partnership, whether you could work, collaborate with some people fractionally, whether you could do that kind of work. So that's something that we step into. We never act as an employee. That's not something that we kind of want to do. Or we act with people where they're just really trying to do massive growth. That's one thing. So we've done that with hosting companies as well. And often you can have 101 ideas, but working out which of those ideas you should be doing is often hard if you are within the company. And it's a lot easier if you're outside to run workshops and give you that perspective. Similar, if you have a product, you probably can think there are 400 things that are really important that you should do. But outside perspective can actually tell you what the one thing is going to get you that partnership that's going to get you to that next level, because you can prove that partnership is going to get you to that next level and have that conversation. So it's always at that kind of, I don't like crisis, it's always at the stress point, right? But stress is a good thing from a business mm-hmm. perspective, because stress can mean that it's a good stress, because it's a if we get through this, it's going to be really productive for us. But it's a stress test of, can we grow? Can we do this? So yeah, those are the kind of conversations. I've also had it where someone's like, can this plugin even survive anymore? Should this plugin survive in this space? What does it do? How does it pivot in the changing WordPress? So there's lots of different kind of conversations. We've worked with BigCommerce. We've worked with a range of different people in that. So yeah, it doesn't vary. And it started out just being less than part-time. It's now kind of part-time work. And it's really interesting what we do across those.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. Well, tell us about your sort of journey into WordPress and or tech. I mean, this isn't necessarily a WordPress specific podcast. It's more broadly people who do techie things in general. What brought you to the nerdy Cody side of things?
So I think by my generation, so I'm a 1975, so I think I was like born at the time that tech formed around me. So I think most people who like, I had my 50th a month or so ago now, but I think anyone who is that age, all the major tech things kind of happened. So we are of that, right? Like it was there. Computers happened. The first computer at like primary school, which is like the first school that you go to in England, happened to me, right? Like the first computer labs at secondary school happened to me. So I've always been really curious at, and this is maybe my mindset at taking things apart. So I was the kid that would try and break things, take things apart, so computers to me were just another way of like extending that. I was kind of surrounded by technology. I was quite lucky that I was enabled to kind of have that. And very early on, the only problem I had was, and I'll be quite honest about it, was my gender. And very early on, it was, you're a bit arty. Well, you're also a woman, therefore you must go and study art, which we don't quite do now, which is better. But then again, I was always doing technical art. So it was photography. And painting were my art form. So I was always trying to do something technical. I was always trying to do early video, which is also hilarious to think of how we used to do it. And then I went, and after trying to do art, it's a long story because technology is long. So I had always been like trying to have technology, trying to use it in whatever way that I could. Even though like I was on that path, I now know it was maybe the wrong path, but you know, things were maybe more locked in those days from a gender perspective. And also really like the web wasn't a thing then. And I think we have to kind of have a reality snap about what was around. The web was Linux, you know, the browser, yeah. Like that was it. Right. Yep. And it wasn't even formed. It was those kind of things. And I remember being at university and MUDs was kind of the thing. Like that would be how you would interact. That we didn't have graphical. I sound super archaic saying this, but that was the thing. And then when I did art, I graduated and I thought, I like eating, so I'm going to be training computers because there's this new thing called web. And I hear you can like combine images, and you remember those rotating GIFs, the like the globes and things. I learned that and haven't kind of looked back since then. I learned about the new language called PHP at that stage. Again, I am super dating myself. But my first ever computer, and this really will date me, was an Acorn Electron. And I don't know who would even know
that.
So in England, we have BBC computers, and their collection was even a rarer version of the BBC computer. And it was BBC Basic. And it was like it's not a language. But it's very Python-esque is the best way I would describe it. That was my first language that I learned. Again, you know, turning down the cassette because the sound was too loud and all those things. So yeah, that's a long-winded one. But yeah, that was how I kind of fell into it, and then fell into Linux, and slowly all the technologies happened around me. So I've been very lucky that it's formed. So I've got to learn it at the pace. I've got to be able to adopt it at that rate because I've been in it.
I remember, so I didn't get my first computer until I was in high school. So I was using like computer labs and other things. The first computer I used was probably like an Apple IIe at like, you know, a tiny little closet that was refactored into a school like computer lab, and you played like Math Blaster and whatever. But I remember when the web was a thing, like a new thing, and going to the library and getting on their computer that had internet access, and like just sitting in front of a Yahoo screen and spending 2 hours just clicking on links and like cross links and like you know, like there's web rings was a thing. But when I finally did get my computer, and I figured out how to get it on the internet, the choice that I made, and I did make a choice at a certain point to pay money for access, but I decided that the thing that I wanted to do was I was more interested in connecting to BBSs than I was getting access to the internet, because I think at the time I either hadn't figured out that you could, or it was not easy to get onto the BBSs and talk to human beings. As it was to, like, they were two separate things. And I think I eventually figured out later that you could use, like, can't remember what the stupid Windows program at the time was, like, but to, like, you could telnet into the BBS. But for a long time, it was like you had to actually dial a phone number to access the BBS. And so I was paying $20 a month for BBS access rather than internet access. So yeah, I mean, I think we sort of came up in the same sort of era where the web
and a lot of that though wasn't available in England, which is kind of the interesting thing. So England has even like less stuff like that available, and I remember like reading on forums about like what America had available and wanting to have things, and then suddenly things like you'd be able to like port in and do. So you had to get very
hyper-terminal. Hyperterminal was the app.
You had to get very technically. So the thing was, if you were into these things and you were in certain countries, you had to get very curious, and you had to get very good at getting around different things. Because also, like, that we weren't traveling, we weren't getting on planes and going into it. We were kids, right? Like you weren't doing stuff like that.
And there wasn't internet to tell you how to do things. Like you couldn't just do
And there weren't mobile phones, which is also a really interesting thing, right? This was the thing I had the reflection the other day. It's like I used to build every computer that I had, and I used to take such pride in, you know, ground yourself when you put your memory. Like that was such, I don't know whether that was worth it.
I didn't know that you were supposed to, so I didn't, if that means anything.
See, the thing with me is, culturally and also me, you tell me a rule, like, I'm going to follow it like that. So you're meant to, I think, so I did hardware. I did like a course in it, and you're meant to like put this thing around your wrist and then ground yourself. So I think that was my problem. I got told but I also was probably doing it on a super dusty floor at the time. So I was negating anything that was going on. But I was grounding.
Of course.
That was the thing. We took such pride in that. And then you would like, you would paint or you would mark like the outside casing because it was your only thing that you could, or your keyboard or your mouse was your only like way. And then on your massive, which is probably why I have such bad eyesight, your massive monitors, you'd put like little creatures and stuff and store it. And it was always this thing of like personalization. And I think you can kind of maybe tell someone that's going up from that with the stickers we still have on our laptops or the fact we're still trying to like have that personalization. But being able to grow and have technology around that, the interface, I think it has helped us be able to like, I had a reflection the other day, like, if you turned up and you're a kid now, I don't know where you start. Like, I think my head would explode with having to know everything.
Yeah.
So at least I got to like be onboarded with all of this when my brain was a little bit more flexible.
Yeah, so my first computer was an NEC, which also doesn't exist. So BBC computers don't exist. And NEC is obviously Nintendo Entertainment Corporation, because there was a period of time where they made computers, not a very long period of time. And then after that, I did sort of graduate to building my own computer because I was reading computer magazines a lot at the time. And so I was hearing all this stuff and like looking at ads and figuring out, like, I like priced out my computer for months and months and months and like figured out how much I needed to save to get a computer.
Yeah.
And also because I was reading computer magazines, I was reading about things like Linux. I think I had a copy of a couple different Linux distributions on CD. I think they were on CD. I don't think I had any floppy disks or...
Yeah, well, you generally, floppy, on those, you would have... So that's how I got into... Like, I mean, Windows would have been in like this just about... I mean, it would have been DOS, I guess. Just about. And then Windows. But then Linux was really my first kind of operating systems because... I couldn't afford anything else. So it was like, and you would get the free versions on those CDs. And a lot of those CDs were in secondhand shops. So you would pick them up in secondhand stores and then you'd get the programs. They were like super out of date. But you were fine to use them and you could get like, so that was the thing. Like you could, or you traded them with people and people gave them to you. And it, weird trading going on. But distros were passing around for people and it would always be Linux distribution. And it was just a different time, I think. So I think one of the first kind of art programs I learned was through Linux rather than through anything else. And then eventually learning, okay, there's other stuff and other applications and slowly doing it, but having to learn it for work roles and then having to like hyperspeed myself onto those kind of platforms. But I think that that kind of got me the foundation of like access, being able to give it. And I've kind of kept that going, hopefully.
Well, yeah, I mean, we met in person a few months ago at PressConf, and one of the things that I remember being really impressed by in your talk, besides obviously the substance was awesome, was that all of your slides you had hand illustrated. Talk about your artistic journey and possibly how it, I mean, we've talked a little bit about how it relates to technology, but like, what does that interplay kind of look like for you?
Yeah, so originally I kind of gave up on it. And I think I gave up on it because if you're really, really lucky as an artist, you get to not starve. And I'm not bad at art, but I'm not one of the 0.0.0.0.0 whatever that leave art school and end up being able to make a career of it. And that's okay. It's totally fine. So I left, and starving artist is not a look that I wanted to go for. And I actually was lucky enough that I could retrain. I actually, in hindsight, I now know I've been kind of combining it all the way through. I also had studied psychology, so I've had like probably three careers by the time I was quite young, and then I have just stuck to one for a while. And the way that I think I'm doing is now, as I'm getting older, I'm kind of rediscovering those careers and getting back to them. It's a weird kind of mind shift, but I think a lot of people do that. I don't think that's abnormal. I think you kind of find the bits of you that you've left behind, not left, but you didn't, couldn't do because you had to go into certain, you need money, right? Because life. So I was quite lucky because the web happened, I could do that. And the thing initially with the web is I was always trying to find a way, so from Flash to different things, because I understood the way things should form. And bear in mind, when I first started kind of making websites, user experience wasn't really known about, what, like put a button on it, right? No one was talking about user journeys. No mm-hmm. one was knowing about the benefits of AI sparkles or not. No one was talking about whether what was the correct flow or what was right or wrong about navigation. No one knew what was good or bad about accessibility or a tag or anything mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. like they were just about doing a spinning globe.
Yeah.
Right. So I could do that. And in fact, a lot of what I was trying to do was not visual. A lot of it was content management and just trying to get navigation through. But I always could work those paths through and I could always like work out content because I had that understanding and because of my art kind of background. So it always stood me in good stead along with this kind of psychology background. And then over time, I've kind of kindle that art through technology. I think that's the best way. Photography has always been a thing, although I resisted for a very long time getting into digital photography. Mm-hmm. I hated it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are the same, I think. I used to think it was just me and I was weird, but in fact, no, it's not. Now I love it and I'm trying to get the smaller and smaller camera. But I think it's a real, like, it took me a long time to be okay about not hand processing. I'm okay now. It's all good. Now, though, what I really like doing and kind of skipping forward is I love taking a photograph, giving it to AI, letting AI do something with it, and then me painting that. Right. That's one of the things I really enjoy. I also love just doing like processing art and doing like that kind of generative art is one of the things that I don't get enough time to do that, but I really enjoy it. And kind of tangent to that, I even love doing things and I kind of still form it as art, like yarn. Like I love mm-hmm. knitting and that's kind of like physical art with mm-hmm. maps,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I still, things like that, I still do. I don't get enough time for a lot. I'm trying, as I kind of get older, I try and make more time for those. And I hope eventually I will get part-time for those. But I think that's what we all do. Like, as we kind of get older, we get part-time to rediscover those things. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you also spent a long time working on the very early version of the block editor in WordPress. Mm-hmm. Talk about that process. That mm-hmm. was a period of time that was, it was very, there's a lot of heated debate about the block editor. Yeah. I remember myself being mm-hmm. feeling like, is this a thing that we really need? And like, it doesn't matter if we need it or not, because we're getting it.
Yeah.
And there is, I feel like at least for some curmudgeonly old WordPressers like me, it was like, you know, there's a little bit of a resentment towards this new thing just because it was like a thing that we didn't know. And now we have to learn JavaScript and React and I'm a PHP developer and I can't possibly learn new things. And like, talk about what your experience of being involved in that project was like.
So I think the interesting thing was that at one point, the people who were like me and some other people, it's like you couldn't see our faces. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best way to describe it, because I've been in the project.
It was
project
just this thing that was happening in the
dark. Like I'd been in the project. I was PHP. Like that was, I already shared like the new language. That was like one of the first languages I really kind of, the web that I dove into. In fact, I remember writing a essay on this new language called PHP and why it was going to change the web. Right? Like I learned JavaScript as part, very roughly, as part of the editor. So mm-hmm. I was on that journey myself as well. And I think a lot of people kind of forgot that we were themers. We were people who had the best intent of WordPress. I didn't wake up one morning, disconnect myself, get a bonk on my head and decide that I wanted the worst for WordPress, right? Like that's being very flippant and English about it, but that's not what happened to me, right? And I think it's very easy to not see the humans, not see the people and not see that what they're trying to do on both sides. And I think when you're making something, it's very easy to not see anyone else because it's super exciting. Like when you're making something and you're making something new, I'm a maker and I love making. When I'm talking about making, I'm like super excited, right? Like I am like, ah, this is cold. Like, and we've had conversations about like, you can just nerd out and I'm like, ah, this is amazing. And you do that. And when you're on a project and you can nerd out with people and you're really focusing on something, it's great. You are completely like obsessed in that. And it's, if someone is shouting at you, I like most people, if someone shouts at me, I don't want to listen too much because it turns out that we don't like people shouting at us. Mm-hmm. So it's quite hard. What I found I consciously had to do was bring in that kind of usability and that like psychology training of myself to listen. So the one-star reviews were something I did a lot of responding to and a lot of listening, a lot of usability testing. I like to call it usability, not user testing, because I'm not testing on humans or animals. Mm-hmm. That's my thing. So anyway, a little bit. I just find it weird to say that you use the testing. It's a bit strange. Although curious. And just kind of going and watching. And every time I did that, it helped me. Every time that I talked to someone, it helped me. But yeah, it's not, it's hard because you're being, your history, your, what you want is being removed. You can't argue with someone who's done that, or not that you can't discuss. I'm not going to argue. I don't argue. I will probably just walk off and go and play with a puppy. I don't do well in arguments. I can't argue. That's fine. I learned a long time ago, I'm not that type of person. But some people really, really can. And that's okay. But not over here. So I think that that's the thing. A lot of people still feel that their things were changed, their difference, but generally what it was how can I use this thing stopping me do something that I want to do? And when you listen to that, you could either have a discussion about, okay, but what do you need to do and how do we get you to do that? That was super helpful. Or we could have okay, we hadn't thought of that situation. Let's now change this because now you've given us that information. And that was one of the big things, was trying to get that input. There was a time, and I remember distinctly, of like, we just need input, not shouting, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a good way. Like, it's great we're having like some input, but what we need is input you can then take action in some direction about. And I think that that's kind of the thing. And it wasn't all negative. And I think that's the thing, like whenever something comes out, these big projects, it's one of those ones where if you look back, it would be really unjust on the project to say like, it was all bad, or it all felt all bad, because it really didn't. There were some beautiful moments, there were some beautiful spots, but it does take its toll on the people that were involved. And I think in hindsight, there are better ways to do it. It certainly taught me how I will want to approach projects, how I want to approach releasing things, how I want to approach communities, how I want to approach the work that I do. And I think in general, like product work, how I want to approach it. There's a point where you listen, but you still have to take action. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that time, even in WordPress, we often say like, give us feedback, but we don't say when that feedback, we want you to stop with the feedback, and then we summarize it and give action. And we actually changed that. There was a point during the project where we changed to start doing that, and it started to be more positive because we started to do that, and we were just like, okay, now we're actually giving you that. And that's the thing, like we're setting like that tone, and I think it's a good way. So yeah, there's no good answers on things like that, and I think everybody has to look back and take a lot of lessons from those projects. I think WordPress is full of these lessons if we take time to learn them. Any mm-hmm. open source project is full of that. Mm-hmm. But we sometimes move so fast we don't take those lessons. I was lucky I had a sabbatical, so I could take some of those lessons afterwards and go, okay, here's those lessons I'm going to take into my next bit of work. And I have, but I would encourage anyone to take like a couple of weekends, and if they do any open source work, try and journal about like, what have they learned? You know, do an end of year. What did you learn this year in your open source work?
Yeah, I want to come back to that because I want to talk about sabbaticals, because I've never had a sabbatical. But I you mentioned sort of like this idea of it's really easy to sort of surround yourself in a bubble and be like not even see the outside for a while. And I remember, when I was working at Human Made, and we were doing a lot of Gutenberg stuff, and I had been doing a lot of Gutenberg stuff, and I went to WordCamp Long Beach to give a presentation on Gutenberg. And it was a really like introduction, like this is why you should care about Gutenberg. And I knew that there was a lot of like negative feeling about it. And I was like, at this point, I was like gung ho, like Gutenberg is the thing. And it was really interesting because, first of all, the majority of my talk was over the audience's head because they didn't care about or want to care about Gutenberg at that time. It was 2019, which is still, well after, it had been around for a while. But people were very, at least the people who had been using WordPress, and a lot of these are like business owners, small business owners, and like, users just like, I don't want to learn a new thing. Why do I need to learn a new thing?
They haven't got time to learn the new
Exactly,
thing, right?
exactly. And it was a little bit sort of eye-opening to come to the realization, like kind of in front of an audience, that, oh, I'm actually super privileged because I work at an agency that is able to create these bespoke, like curated experiences for our clients and build these really cool things. But the majority of people aren't in that situation. And they're using what they can find, either that's built into Core or through a plugin or whatever, and that might match the thing that they want, or it might kind of come close and they can kind of make it work. But they're not getting the thing that I am excited about building. And they're not capable of building the thing that me and my team are building. And that was a really interesting sort of like revelation that like it made me realize how much of a bubble I was in.
So the bit that you say, the privilege, I've tried to remember that and remember that feeling. Now I'm like, and now I'm in a different situation because now I'm not a full-time contributor. Now I kind of do what I do, but I still contribute, right? And so I try and both remember what it's like for the full-time contributors, and I also try and remember what it's like for the product makers, because I definitely sit between two now. I try and remember that when I'm doing AI work. I try and remember that when I don't have enough time to learn and I get frustrated, because part of me does now. I'm like, I want to knit this weekend. I don't want to do AI, but actually I generally want to do AI, not knit. But yeah, okay. And I have these arguments between myself about like time, and I try and tell myself that I need like to rest and all these kind of things. Or when I get caught up with someone who's a full-time contributor, and I'm like, hang on, no, we need to take this outside, right? Like, it is really difficult to kind of remember and put yourself. I feel quite privileged to be able to kind of have that and then still be in one a space. Quite a lot of people maybe leave the spaces, don't kind of do it. So it's something that I feel lucky to kind of still be building in this space and making in this space. I hope to continue for a while to make in this space. Not done yet. But it's one, it's an interesting, you have to recognize the privilege of making that you have and where you are on that scale. And that's something I definitely had a number of times, because we kind of were going around giving talks about Gutenberg, and there were so many times when I had this, and good and bad body language, right, of people. And you have a, like, when you're speaking, you will notice someone's body language and you'll be like, oh, or the one-on-ones were also for me, when someone just asks you a question and you're like, why is that not documentation? Why could you not find that for yourself? And why is everybody else that I'm talking about excited about that? And you're so scared, and you look at them and they have fear about that thing. And there was real fear from people. And that was something to be like, okay, I'm gonna like listen to the fear. Generally, when it's in an extreme emotion, you can talk through the extreme emotions. And really like kind of get to the root of those ones, because it's generally like a bit of information they needed. Like fear comes from lack of information generally.
Yeah, talk about so let's go back to the sabbatical. I want to hear about it. I want to hear, like, I think at the time you were probably working at Automattic. Automattic makes it very well known that after you have a certain amount of tenure, then you are welcome to take a sabbatical. What is a, like, how long, what does that mean? What does that look like? I've also observed, and since I've, you know, watched the company from the sidelines for many years, that it's not super uncommon for someone to go away on a sabbatical and then come back and then realize that they're in a different place than they were when they left. And then maybe a few months later or a year later, they're like, yep, you know what, I'm done here. I'm going to go off and do this other thing that I kind of explored a little bit in my sabbatical. Talk about what that's like, and just having the opportunity, what you did, how does that work?
Yeah, so my sabbatical, so nobody wanted Gutenberg to be released as much as me, because my sabbatical was ending up. And it was a little bit delayed because there were a few of us. So there wasn't, you know, people really wanted it to be released. That's a half joke. But for me, and in fact, it's encouraged. Different companies have sabbaticals in different ways. So I think I've only had one sabbatical in one company. Right. So that is all my experience. I hope that if my own company grows, I will install this practice. And I guess that there's something telling in that. And the reason why I think it is an honor to be able to say to someone for a month or 3 months or whatever set time to say, I trust you enough. I'm going to give you some time. You've done really awesome in the work you're going to do, and you don't have to think about work for this set amount of time. For me, what it allowed me to do was recharge and detox. And that's what I did. And the way that I did it was by rediscovering painting. It hit in like a time where we weren't traveling, we weren't going around, the small thing of the pandemic. But it actually was pretty perfect for me because of that. I got to kind of recharge, really rediscover, like sort out a lot of, like get really back down to practice, getting up in the morning, painting, going to bed, finishing. And I got to finish some pieces and that type of thing, do what I maybe would have done in another life, which I think is like one of the things that people find. They try on what they could have done in another life. That's kind of like going back to that thing of like being able to, what would you have done in your other lives that you could have lived? Which I guess is very much a reflection you have as you kind of get older as well, like that reflection. But with sabbaticals give you that reflection at any age to be able to check that out. I've seen other people do go and do massive travels and stuff. I was quite lucky. I did quite a lot of travel with work. So for me, actually not traveling was a real nice thing. Not having to get on any planes was also really good. That was a really small life was actually what I did with my sabbatical. I had no, like, often people have major plans. I did a lot of really small things. And it was really important to me to do really small things. And the small things kind of mattered to me, cleaned my brain and sorted that out a lot.
Yeah, I say that I didn't go on sabbatical, but I actually went on a compassionate leave, which kind of served the same purpose at the time. It was during pandemic, and my partner had shattered her knee. We were riding bikes with the kids, and I think there was like one of the kids swerved in front of her, and she moved to not crash into the and like landed square on her knee. Needed like lots of surgery and was essentially bedridden for a while. And then even when she wasn't, she's like on crutches for a really long time. So I was lucky enough that I was working at Human Made, and they let me take compassionate leave to take care of her and the family, because you know she was a stay-at-home mom. So like that I needed to assume that role. I did that. And but at the time it also coincided with I was super burned out, and I was at least at the point of burnout where I realized I was burned out because there was a period of time when I was burnt out and I didn't realize I was burnt out. I just thought I sucked. and like I was going through like, I can't do this anymore. I can't compete in like this. I can't be a developer. I'm like horrible. Mm. I'm never going to like be any better than I am today. Everything is bad. And then there's a certain point of like, no, I'm burnt out and I need time. And it just sort of coincided with when this happened, like that, that compassionate leave was also sort of like my burnout retreat. And the thing, so during the pandemic, you know, some people got into sourdough. I got into D&D. and I went really hard into D&D.
I got really into Animal Crossing.
A lot of people did.
I so did.
I got super into D&D because I had been running a game for my kids, and then when the pandemic hit and we stopped being able to play in person, that was when I realized, oh, this isn't just for the kids anymore. Yeah. This is a creative outlet that my brain needs now, and that I now that I took it away, like I am struggling. And one of the things that I did during the pandemic was, or during the my compassionate leave, was get super deeper into D&D things. I spent hours like building there's a platform called Roll20, and they have like you know, it's a tabletop, virtual tabletop, and you can make maps and you can import maps and you can do all sorts of lighting things. And I spent like days putting lighting effects on this map that I got from somewhere else that was this ridiculously large multi-level dungeon. And I was doing all of the like the walls and the lighting effects for everything so I could run it. And it was not nearly like, it was not nearly as good as you could have done, but I was like, is really painstaking work, right? And there was, and then, and to your point of like thinking about like what you could do in another life, I, at the time, there was the emergence of the idea of like a paid dungeon master. And I mean, that exists now. There's websites like startplaying.games where people sell their services as a dungeon master or a game master for whatever game. And I had the thought, you know, if in the perfect world, this would be really cool. And also, I'm doing so much work, I should definitely be paid for all of this.
See, that's where, so I had this reflection the other day about like where AI, like I feel like some of the stuff I'm doing with AI now and the lower end stuff I'm letting it do, right, the workflow stuff, so that I can do more of the stuff that I know that helps me from the burnout, which I think is good, right? Like it's all good because I'm then recharging myself. And I think like if we start to see like where can we continue to use tools, can we continue to have workflows? I don't know whether this is true for you, but since I now know it's burnout. For a long time, I was like, I'm not burnt out. I will never have burnout. That's such a Gen X thing. Burnout's for not me.
For other people.
I was like, no, sounds we're all there. But the reality is that I don't ever want to have it again because it was really long. And I'm pretty solid out of it now. And the reason I'm out of it is I have a lot of processes and systems in place, and I now know what to do. And I use quite a bit of technology to do that. And I'm using more and more of the technologies that I can do. I don't know if that's the case for you, that you're like, where can I systemize to particularly lean on like workflows? Where can I use AI to be faster? And when I mean AI, I'm using this general bucket of anything that's new that has a sparkle on it, technology.
Actually, my partner and I were having a conversation about this yesterday because we got into this debate about like, we had this conversation a couple months ago about, I think at the time I had recently read an article about how, or seen an interview about how Spotify, the way that it, like, it has like secret sort of partnerships with like royalty-free music companies that like add like sort of fake artists that they then inject into some of their Discover playlists and things like that, because it's basically cheaper for them. And so like when you're listening to a Spotify generated playlist, you're listening to a thing that Spotify thinks you should listen to based on maybe your behavior, but also with these like maybe a insidious little thing inserted in there so that they can get some revenue out of that. and it takes sort of like your own sort of brain out of it. And the counterpoint to that is like, well, you can be more intentional about like the Spotify playlist that you make. You can stop listening to Spotify and go back to like MP3s, which I've also done. But like also
iPod Classic now.
And I've done that too. And I've gone back. I found my removable hard drive that had my MP3 collection. I've added it to the network. I've started listening to that. And one of the things that I've realized is that you lose like the one thing that I feel like Spotify used to be able to do pretty well. It kind of sort of does it okay. And something that Pandora used to do really well was the idea of, okay, I see where you are, and I'm going to give you some things that you don't know about, or that I don't think that you know about. Sprinkle in some things that I think that you would like that you haven't told me that you already like. Sort of discovery aspect. Yeah. Whereas, like, if I'm just listening to my MP3s, there's like I can try to give it like a discovery like experience, like some obscure B-side or something that that's not on the regular loop. But it's still like coming from my own thing. And I think what I realized actually, just like literally the other day, is that like I did a massive collection of MP3s. And I would go deep into the sort of like music history of things. Like I would get deep into like I discovered like an artist, and I would be like, okay, I'm gonna go find all of the albums by this artist, and like and that was discovery. So that when, because what I really like is a playlist that you know, as a music nerd, as a DJ, as somebody who likes to share music with other people, what I really like is I like both the experience of discovering something for the first time that I like, but also listening to the things that are like in the same vibe. So I would like, I created this really huge, massive collection partially because I wanted to be surprised. And that's a thing where like without other people, it's hard, like especially with music. And I was reading a thing, an article by NPR about like the like music discovery requires people or requires inputs, because you're not gonna, and like radios don't exist anymore. We're all streaming services now. So there's like this it's harder to discover music now than maybe it was when we all lived on a college campus, or when we're sharing
the tapes. This reminds me a little bit. I think it's very easy to be binary about technology, right? It's very easy to be like, I'm just going to use old tech. And I noticed when I brought, because the algorithms are amazing, and when I just brought my iPod Classic, of course the algorithms picked up that I had bought my iPod Classic, so I was getting very targeted by that, and it's like all this old tech. I was like, nah, I don't want just old tech, I want to pick the new tech that works for me and the old tech that works for me. A good example is I actually have two iPads, and actually the one that I use is the iPad Mini more. I do have a big one, but that's great for when I'm drawing, but the iPad Mini, perfect form for me. It is, I don't know, but it works. It's like perfect. Turns out my Kindle could be a doorstop for some reason, but I'm okay reading Kindle stuff on my iPad Mini. So, but that's as a, another person would have very different. And I think that's the thing we maybe forget, that in those kind of days of past, we didn't have a choice, right? It was just one device and you had to get used to it. So we maybe look a bit for it with these like rose-tinted glasses a little bit, and we're like, oh, that technology is all great. Well, it didn't fit us.
Yeah.
It wasn't like one size fit all. Like now some people want to have a Apple Watch and people don't. They want to have a different wearable device, right? They want to have a ring, or they want to have a different thing. And that's great. Like the technology is coming. I'm still waiting for the glasses that work really well for astigmatism. That would be so good. Can we have those, please? But it's that just enough, right? Like, and it's so personal. And that's the thing, the workflows. And one of the things I feel now is critical is that we don't say this works, so therefore it's going to work for everybody. And that's what I really try and work when I'm working with product makers or when I'm working with companies. I'm like, okay, I want to listen first to what your workflows are. And that's maybe the difference I do to when I was doing the editor, like back even 3-4 years ago, we all thought there was one way of doing things. 5 years ago, right? We thought there's one way of doing products, there's one way of doing things, there's one way of doing everything. We're actually a little bit smarter than that now. And we're realizing there's many different ways to make products, there's many different ways to do things. And there's no right or wrong way. There's a good result, and then there's that maybe needs a bit of iteration, right? But along the way, there are variations to that. There can be recommendations, there can be good testing, there can be not so great testing, but there's no GitHub labels. There's no one labeling system that will work in every single case, right? That went super wide, but I think we have to, like, even down to what we have in devices that work, we have to be a little bit more eclectic in what we have. And I think the kind of longer that we're in, I find I'm in tech, the more eclectic my bag is that I'm wandering around with. It's an extremely eclectic collection of devices, and I think that's okay. Like, I've been looking at the, you know, I've got my Mac, but the framework laptop I absolutely adore. Mm-hmm. And I do think at some point I'm going to have one, but that will be my gaming laptop, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you feel the same. Like, it's picking and choosing the best thing for you, right? Yeah. And I think that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The framework laptops look really cool.
They do. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a really good place to stop. I think that's thank you very much for coming on to the show again. I say again for the listeners, it's not again, but for me, it's again. We won't talk about what happened, but you can read about it on the website. But speaking of websites, where can people find you online?
So you can find me on Comatose on all the things. That's probably the easiest way. And bynightthoughts.com is where I write things. And I'm trying to write more because I also think we should start writing more.
Yes, absolutely. Well, again, thank you for coming on, Tammy. And thank you
so
all
much for having me.
Thank you. You're welcome. And thank everyone for listening or watching the show. And we'll see you on the internet.